From Columbia Square in Hollywood, California, CBS presents Carlisle Stevens' Sketchbook, with the music of Wilbur Hatch and the Columbia Orchestra and the Westerners Quartet. We reproduce these impressions and tones, pictures and words and melodies, landscapes, portraits, delicate etchings from over the world, created in deft, masterful strokes. And on the feature page, a story of circumstance and the fate of a nation. Turning the pages of the sketchbook, Carlisle Stevens.
Good evening. Looking at these pictures just now, I had an idea. I wanted you to see them. See them in your mind's eye and hear them through the music which they themselves sing. Here, let's look for a moment at this sketch. A scene of splendor. Ladies in graceful white gowns, men in imperial uniforms. The low hum of speech fades suddenly as the lights flash out. The magnificent blue curtain flutters, parts, then slowly sweeps back. It's Petrograd of a quarter century ago. The opera house, the night of the ballet. There on the stage are the dancers. And there the music. And now the dance.
Thank you.
across the page a scene of fine, hearty fellowship, a painting of the soldiers of Her Majesty, England. Their swords removed, their rich red jackets open at the throat, their faces beaming as they gather about the canteen table in the regimental song. This one. The sun pauses a moment to pour slanting rays upon a blue-domed Mohammedan mosque and a departing desert caravan. And then suddenly the great red disk sinks behind the distant sand dune. And softly from a night filled with a myriad of new stars floats the darkening purple mantle of evening. And mystery, like unseen vapors low across the earth, creeps into nocturnal Tangier. Suddenly, the noonday lull is blasted. Doors open cautiously and then fly shut. For down into town roars a monstrous beast panting flame and purple steam, wagging 13 spiked tails and searching with eyes green as tree toads for policeman Pie and fresh little boy. It's the green-eyed dragon, that's what it is.
Once upon a time, this fair young princess, most beautiful and charming. Her father, the king, was a wicked old thing, this man most alarming. And always on the front door mat, the most ferocious dragon sat.
It makes an awful creaking noise, so all you little girls and boys, beware,
beware,
take care of the green eyed dragon with the 13 tails. He'll feed with greed on little boys, puppy dogs, and big fat snails. Then off to his lair, each child will drag and meet with the 13 tails. He'll wag,
beware,
take care, and drink for fun his then hurry up, then say a prayer, and duck your head, pray for the head. Beneath the clothes.
That dragon he lived for years and years, but he never grew much thinner. For lunch he'd try a policeman pile, a congressman for dinner. One brave man went round with a mat and tried to collect his income tax. The dragon he found his feet and sadly murmured,
R.I.P.
Beware,
take care
of the green-eyed dragon with the 13 tails.
You feed with greed on little boys, puppy dogs, and big fat snails. Then off to his lair, each time the dragon meets you with 13 tails, you might as well
take care and creep up on his
Beneath the
floor,
the
floor, the floor. That dragon
went down to kitchen one day with a fair princess was making. He ate by mistake some rich plum cake that the fair princess was making.
That homemade cake he could not digest. He moaned and he groaned that at last went worse. And now his ghost bloodshot eyes at midnight times his pain.
Take care
of the green-eyed dragon with the 13 tails. You feed with greed on little boys, puppy dogs, and big fat snails. Then off to his lair, each time you drag him, each of his 13 tails, you wipe his way.
Take care,
and creep on his toes. Then hurry up the stairs and say your prayers and tuck up your
pretty head
beneath the floor.
This is a painting of a country where men of the same breed fought for opposing ideals. A story of war and intrigue, and of the moving pendulum of circumstances. It's a story of the importance of trifles. Abuse and tyranny had been heaped upon the people of this provincial country until there was revolt. Small, scattered groups of rebels made heroic and foolish little attempts to assert themselves. They were disarmed, swept to the ground with the playful, cynical tolerance of well-trained royal troops. But steadily revolt spread, and soon there grew from this mere struggle for human rights a fixed idea. These rebels were demanding absolute freedom. Then the smiles faded from the faces of the loyalists. This must be crushed. And so there was war in earnest. War between picked mercenaries garbed in bright blue gold-braided jackets and rebels in tatters not half so bright as the zeal in their eyes. This side had fire. The loyalists had might and skill and wealth. For a long while, the factions were balanced. The two most important cities of this nation in arms were occupied by loyalist troops. At the one to the south was stationed a young officer of noble and impressive bearing. Among the young people of the city, he was a popular figure. But of all the young ladies, there was one lovely girl who appealed to him most. And they made a splendid couple, whether they were strolling through the streets or, as on one memorable evening, dancing in the great ballroom of a private home. That night, the rumble of war seemed far away, cast out of hearing by the graceful strains of a minuet. The two of them stepped out upon the balcony under a great yellow moon. John knew he would remember this night, for within the next 3 days, his company would be leaving the city. The rebel forces were coming nearer, and for purposes of strategy, the loyalist troops had been ordered to evacuate. For a while, at least, this would be his goodbye. He touched her arm and started to speak. But just then, she glanced up. John, do you think me capable of falling in love with one who is dishonorable? The suddenness of her question stunned him. She went on. Recently, in a nearby town, she had met an officer about whom there had been much whispering. A brilliant soldier, yes, but disloyal. She had regarded the accusations as cruel and baseless. And she had been unable to prevent herself from falling in love with him. Somehow, for John, the fact that that man was a rebel officer had little to do with his disappointment. Presently, he looked down at the exquisite girl beside him. Margaret, he could hardly be a dishonorable man and earn the love of a girl like you. Later, the loyalist troops left the city, and on their heels came the rebel forces. As John learned through Margaret's letter, they were under the command of her officer. And as he learned from another letter a few weeks later, they were married. That letter he saved. But now his duties occupied all his thoughts. The main objective of his troops was to open up a pathway to the north, which would enable loyalist forces from that section to sweep southward and capture the rebel territory. The most direct pathway was that afforded by the river. But that way was blocked by a mighty fortress, the major stronghold of the weakened rebel army. Furthermore, that fort was important because it contained the bulk of the rebels' munitions and stores. And then, like an answer to a fervent prayer, a communication from a man high in rebel circles, offering for sale to the loyalists this very fortress. Considering that the rebels were very nearly destitute, that their men were deserting, the possession of such a stronghold could mean but one thing: immediate and decisive victory, the end of the war. Further negotiations with the anonymous man were carried on by post. And so it happened that John discovered the identity of his correspondent. He recognized the distinctive markings of the stationery. Compared it with the letter from Margaret, they matched. This great loyalist benefactor, this rebel traitor, was Margaret's husband. Time came for John to meet the rebel face to face, to conclude the bargain. A dark, moonless night. From a loyalist vessel anchored in the river, John was rowed to the dark, wooded shore, where a tall figure stood, waiting to lead him to the appointed house where they would discuss terms. Perhaps sometime during that night, the thoughts of both of them turned to a single woman. But no word was spoken save those concerning the bargain. At last they were finished. In effect, the sword of the rebels was broken. The two men returned to the shore. The boat was gone. A dull red glow from the opposite bank gave the answer. Circumstance. Circumstance had provided a company of rebels. They had opened fire on the vessel, driving her away. And now John must return to the loyalist lines by horseback, a hard, dangerous ride through enemy territory, with the plans of the fortress concealed on his person. A guide appointed by his fellow conspirator accompanied John through the thick of the enemy lines, then turned back. But loyalist territory was almost in sight, and that meant home and victory, the end of the war. And the horsemen galloped on till suddenly, halt! Three men blocked the road. One of them wore a loyalist uniform. Confidently, John identified himself. But again, circumstance. That uniform had been stolen from a loyalist prison camp. The men were rebels. A moment later, they had the plans of the fortress reduced to scraps of paper. The cold, pale ache of dawn touched the sky as the prisoner stepped out alone into the cleared circle. His questions had all been answered. He knew that his fellow conspirator had found refuge within the loyalist lines. He knew that Margaret had been utterly ignorant of her husband's crime. And he knew that for himself, there would be no soldier's death, no gunfire. Spies die on the gallows. He did not seem aware of the men who stepped up to him. For now, they passed through his mind strangely, like lifetimes condensed into flashing seconds. A picture of a green hill at home. The majestic grace of a minuet. A lovely girl beside him. A furious, lonely ride on horseback with the fate of a nation riding with him. And then... there is today an epitaph upon a monument inscribed, "Here died October 2nd, 1780, Major John Andre of the British Army, who, entering the American lines on a secret mission to Benedict Arnold for the surrender of West Point, was taken prisoner, tried, and condemned as a spy." The sun has set, and now where there was a glare upon desert sand and clumps of cactus and brush, there is evening softness. A cowboy kneeling by the campfire glances up questioningly at the other man. Yes, they've seen it too, that effect of the rising moon upon the plains, and that surely is worth a song.
There's silver on the sea tonight, sprinkled by the moon.
And here on the next page, we find the portrait of an imposing man. See those massive arms pushing back the folds of a royal cloak? The eyes half closed with a deep chuckle which rocks his great plump frame? Ah, a portrait of regal pride. And yet more than a portrait, for in the background, in strokes only a little less bold, moves the pageantry of a grand ball at the palace of this king, Henry VIII. Thank you.
so the last page of tonight's sketchbook is turned. These impressions and tone have been reproduced for you through the music of Wilbur Hatch and the Columbia Orchestra and the Westerners Quartet. And now on the last page of this section of his sketches, Carlisle Stevens writes his name and adds these words.
We hope you've enjoyed these pictures, enjoyed seeing and hearing them. Good night.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.